This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, the slow death of literature, what readers really want.
So this week, Jules was inspired by an article.
Yeah.
That she read.
I'm not sure inspired is the right word, but it did start me thinking. Which, you know, is always a good thing. Something starting me thinking. In theory, it's a good thing. But yeah.
And I think more along the lines of it provoked a rather strong reaction from you.
Well, I'm not sure it did really, because I've come across, just to fill people in, it was Howard Jacobson, who is a literary writer, and to be honest, I don't know if he's any good with his books, because I've only ever read his articles. And,
right.
You know, he's award-winning, so someone must think he's good. but he sort of writes that band of literary fiction that I don't find particularly interesting, so I've never really picked up his books, so you have to bear that in mind when I'm talking about him. I'm not being particularly derogatory. It is just a case of he's clearly on one of those levels where I'm just not interested really in what he's got to say. But he did say something that I've come across quite a lot, and that's a certain snobbery from authors of literary fiction towards those of us who are genre proles. And that's quite irritating, really, because, you know, people who write literary fiction, a lot of them are quite happy to dip into genre fiction when it suits them as part of their, you know, as part of whatever they're creating at that particular moment in time. If you think about Michel Faber, for example, who...
Mm-hmm.
with his great sort of interplanetary epic, which looks at religion. And then there's obviously David Mitchell, who some people would put as more reading group fiction, but I would have called him a literary writer. And he delves into all sorts of things, science fiction, fantasy, ghosts, reincarnation. And I'm not saying these people look down their noses at those of us who write predominantly genre fiction, or even that those who write predominantly genre fiction don't sometimes have literary tendencies or then go on to produce literary fiction. But there does seem to be, amongst those who don't read widely in both categories, really, that's very broad, both categories, a certain amount of snobbery, as in you're not really a very skilled writer, you're not a proper writer if you don't write something literary. So I thought we could look into the background of where this attitude came from, because it might actually surprise people.
Well, the thing that always interests me, and we've said it plenty of times before, is that obviously, well, let's just look at fantasy with Tolkien. The Lord of the Rings was literary fiction.
Well, it wasn't considered literary fiction at the time.
No, was it not? Well, because it wasn't considered fantasy. Fantasy was created via that.
No, it was considered children's fiction, because if you wrote fantasy in that era, you were writing for children. And it didn't matter what the content was. It was considered for children.
That's fair. Because I would have disagreed. I would have said that it was considered adult. Well, okay, originally it might have been. But sort of before the cutoff became apparent, this was, you know, it was an epic in some ways, and you know, literary fiction did include a lot of kind of mythology and stuff like that as well originally. I think the snobbery really comes down to the fact that genre fiction is new. It's very new. Oh, actually,
the classification of it being called genre fiction, yes, that's definitely new.
And it was previous that everything was literary, because so far as I feel, everything was literary because there just wasn't anything else. And for a book to get published, it would need to sort of hit certain standards. And there was an academic connection as well to that. And so that's kind of where the whole literary element was born. And it was born from a very classist, a very racist, a very sexist industry, which basically told everyone what was worthy of reading, and that was the opinions of people who existed within that frame of mind, and nothing else. And every now and again you'd have something which was a little avant-garde, but never too much, really.
Yeah.
And that's where literary fiction was born.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting look, a little bit of a history lesson here. So, Whistle Stop Tour. If we go back to the 18th century, not literally, although if it was cooler, I'd totally go there right
whoosh,
now.
Whoosh, 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 whoosh.
Our time machine sounds like whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Really? Is the TARDIS broken?
Yeah. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. Look, we have budget cuts, okay?
I didn't know we had them here, Dissecting Dragons. You must look into this after the show. Yeah, back to the 18th century. Novels written purely for entertainment were considered just barely tolerable. They were slightly disreputable already. If you were reading, you were reading for improvement. So that meant you ought to be reading things like histories, you ought to be reading the philosophers, you ought to be reading in several different languages. All these things were mind-improving, prop up your education. You didn't read for pure entertainment, that wasn't what it was about. And yet, novels were very popular. And it's very noticeable in a lot of Jane Austen's books that she will have at least one character have a sly pop at the novel. And this is not Jane Austen saying, well, I think novels are crap, because the way she references them, she's clearly read an awful lot of them, and she's written them herself. She's writing them as she reads. It's quite meta. But what she seems to be saying to me is the fact that actually you can get as much intelligent information, much thought-provoking and incisive opinion and insight from a novel, from something that tells you a story and entertains you and yet teaches you along the way, as you can from a great dry treatise of something that is considered mind-improving because it's not packaged as entertainment. And I think that really encapsulates this divide between what's considered literary and what isn't. I suppose we ought to say what we would consider literary fiction now, because that's a tricky one to pin down. Apparently you can't call it literary fiction yourself. If you're a writer and you pitch to an agent and you say you've written a work of literary fiction, they absolutely hate that. That's considered quite insulting. Because that's not for the writer to decide, basically. It's literary when the publisher decides to market it as literary. And you might write something that you consider literary, and the publisher, if you're lucky enough to sell it, will market it as reading group fiction, because reading group fiction is a little, like, subshoot of literary fiction, whereby it's clearly intelligent packaged stuff, but it's written in such a way as to be eligible for reading groups to buy lots of copies of the book and discuss it literally, and that makes it slightly more popular. So it's popular literary fiction, if you like. And okay, so you've got those two things aside. Literary fiction, it's difficult to pin down, because my version of literary fiction won't necessarily be what somebody else's is. I don't mean writing literary fiction, I mean what I read. I would have considered things like Memoirs of a Geisha to be quite literary, and yet other people have said, though they don't, they consider that to be historical general fiction. And I would have said David Mitchell, not the comedian, was quite literary, and yet other people have said, well, you know, that is more reading group fiction. And things like The Essex Serpent, I can see how that's reading group fiction, not literary fiction. And The Crimson Petal and the White, I would have called that literary fiction. Because of the way it's written, and yet other people have said it's historical general fiction. So it's quite difficult to pin down. They're ultimately, what you can take from this is there's no such thing really as literary fiction unless the publisher actually markets it as literary fiction.
Yeah.
Because it varies. Some of the markers seem to be lyrical prose, but then you can have lyrical prose in genre fiction. And some literary fiction doesn't actually have a plot. This is where I sort of part ways with it, because for me, story is king. And if it doesn't tell a good story, as in...
Yeah.
And I'm not even saying it has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, it just has to have some sort of plot. But not all literary fiction does. And that's where I'm a bit sort of, okay, that's too experimental for me. Somebody else might love it, but...
Yeah.
And that's looking at things like character is plot, plot is character kind of thing. But I would, that's not for me. But it's not an absolute requisite of literary fiction to have a plot. I'll come back to that, because that one's going to stick in my craw a little bit.
You have some thoughts about that, I sense.
I do. And then you've got another subshoot, and this one's a bit controversial as well, when you're talking about magical realism. Because there is a lot to say that, and I can kind of see the point, but I'm not 100% on board with it, but that Western authors didn't ought to write or call their writing magical realism, because it was a style of writing that was directly developed in South America in direct correlation to the oppression that was going on there. It was literally the only way they could kind of get the truth out.
Yeah.
And yes, it does originate from there, and I can see the frustration in creating a writing style and then having other people mimic it or use it and think, well, this is great, and yet not bother to learn its history. That's very frustrating.
Yeah.
But then to say, when something is out in the world, that no one else can use it is just a little bit reductive and pointless in a way. Because that's like saying, well, in that case, no man can write science fiction, no woman can. No one except upper middle white class middle aged men can write fantasy. It just gets a bit stupid. If you're only saying that only the original creator or someone like the original creator can use a method of writing fiction, then you're placing limits on something that's already quite limited.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
So magical realism might fall under literary, but it's not necessarily literary in and of itself, although a lot of the magical realism I've read by South American authors I would actually consider literary. So there you go. It's all quite tangled. So have fun with that one.
Well, it makes me think of the Night Circus.
Yeah.
How would you class that?
I would call it literary, but I would also file it under science fiction fantasy, loosely.
Yeah.
It's of the more literary genre fiction in that respect, but I would definitely put it more literary than genre.
Yeah. Definitely has a style of writing. I think the style of writing comes in large part into whether things are categorised as literary fiction.
Yeah, definitely. Or not.
There's a real style. And I think, you know, we must actually also acknowledge the fact that, especially when it comes to literary fiction, there is a real problem with inclusivity. I can't speak.
Inclusivity.
Having a minor stroke. Yes, thank you. It's so hot, I think I might be having a stroke. I have a brain fever. inclusivity. It has said the word you just said.
Yes. Inclusivity.
thank you. With with people of colour and women.
Yeah.
Within that genre. And I think now you will get more sort of women appearing in it, but again, it does tend to be Western white women. And just as you say, you have this great literature coming out of South America and the Mexican population and you know, a lot of the area in general, which would not be called literary fiction. And this subgenre was born also, again, as you said, for other reasons. There's a whole historical basis for why it was born, and why it is so important. But it is the fact that actually it needed to be changed because it couldn't be recognised. It wouldn't be recognised as literary fiction, because literary fiction is so rooted in something that is very archaic. And so I think that's one of the main problems with literary fiction, because on the one side, it is meant to be informative in a lot of ways. It's meant to sort of broaden the mind. It's meant to kind of make you think. And that's not a bad thing. It isn't a bad thing to be provoked into thought. But I think one of the major things that has changed since then is that reading is now a form of entertainment. And also, reading is something that a lot more people can do than before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we were talking 18th century, obviously, you wouldn't have had the lower classes reading. They wouldn't have been able to afford books, and a lot of them couldn't read, or could only read very basically.
Exactly. So you have people, the people who are reading are doing it usually for educational purposes, and also to kind of really provoke this sense of embetterment.
Yes.
If that makes sense. That we are the educated. Look how we can ponder this and we can and think about that. But reading wasn't necessarily done for enjoyment, not in the same way. And then what happened was that actually books did start to appear which were for enjoyment. And I think the Gothic literature sort of really came out, and that those were really more for enjoyment than for any sort of informative. There was also propaganda, you know, tied in with that, but there was propaganda tied in with a lot of literature at the time.
Yeah.
But there was this whole new subset of literature which was coming through, which was no longer about challenging one's mind, but actually about story and entertainment, and actually engaging a very different part of your brain. And this article, which Jules has spoken of and mentioned, and I encourage you guys to all go and read it. I mean, it got on my nerves a little bit.
Yeah.
It got on my tits. Because it comes from this belief that literature, that there are better things, things which are better for you, things which are worthy of more in literature. And the fact of the matter is that actually, it doesn't matter if it's literary fiction, it doesn't matter if it's beautifully written, if it's not engaging, then why should people read it? Why should people devote their time to it? And people saying, oh yeah, literary fiction is falling. And I just want to remind people that actually, on a statistical level, literary fiction may be falling, but it's not taking into account actually the huge rise in readership across the world. And I'm not kidding. Every year we reach new levels of readership. We have more and more people who are able to read. We have more and more people who are picking up books. And it's absolute bollocks that says that this is a generation that isn't interested in books. That's a lie, all right? There are more people who can read now than ever before. I'm more than certain of that. And there are more people picking me up. So yeah, you say, okay, so in comparison to other things which are selling, literary fiction may be down.
Yeah.
But
I mean, that should really tell you about literary fiction rather than that should tell you about readership in general, I think. Because,
exactly.
I mean, what Jacobson says, and I will say here that someone piped up on Twitter to say they were actually at that lecture and they felt that The Guardian quoted him without nuance, if not entirely out of context, and that a lot of it was meant a bit tongue-in-cheek. But the thing is,
yeah,
when you are a genre writer and you've heard this argument over and over and over again, it doesn't matter if the 47th person saying it is actually joking, because it just gets a bit wearing. So
yeah,
and he was a bit down on, you know, people want mysteries, they want crime. Crime is the most massive genre selling to date, and it has a huge readership. We have a huge, every single library in the county has a huge crime section, and that's not an accident. That's because people want crime novels, and
yeah,
it even outsells romance, you know, that which is almost unbelievable, because that is a huge genre that sells as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's skill that goes into writing both of those genres. It's the fact that what people are saying when they don't buy literary novels is, I have a finite amount of time. I want to spend my time with this. I don't want to spend it doing this instead. And for me, that's the same. There are literary novels that I love, and that they are my favourites. They're not necessarily books I'll pull down to like chill out with, or relax with, or, you know, or just, you know, sometimes you reread a book because it's like comfort food to you.
I'm doing it right now. I mean, not right this second, but yeah, I'm just skimming back through the Loch Lomora books.
Yeah, and you know, it's like meeting up with an old friend. And okay, yeah, I'm one of those people who will pull down a 19th century novel and use it as comfort food, and that's clearly my problem. But some really tight literary novels, they're not meant to be comforting like that, so that's absolutely fine. I don't see what the big issue is here. But if we're talking literary in the sense that I believe this chap means it, and bearing in mind, once again, I've not read his books, so I could be completely wrong, in the sense that, in my opinion, would be plotless drivel that's more style than substance, then no, I don't want to spend my limited amount of time reading that. I would rather read a lurid vampire novel, or another epic fantasy, or science fiction, because all of those things have got the ability to make me think as well.
Yeah. The other thing is, what annoys me is that it's this level of literary fiction is the only thing that makes you think. And I'm like, that's absolute bollocks. It's just that literary fiction engages a very different part of your brain. But I don't remember the last time I read a piece of literary fiction which actually included, you know, a homosexual character who wasn't just woe betide me, I am a sinner who is bound for hell. Can you?
Anna Marie McLemore. Although maybe there would be people who would argue with me and say she's not a literary writer, she writes magical realism. And she is a South American author, and her characters are traditionally queer or trans or whatever, and she has wonderful magical realism, so there's a fantasy element in there too.
That's fantastic. So that's really, really good to hear.
Highly recommend it. But you're right, you have to look bloody hard for that sort of representation in literary fiction. You really do. Mm-hmm. You have to look bloody hard for literary fiction that represents anyone who's not white and European, or, you know, white and American.
Yeah.
Another one, probably Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmyn Ward, which deals with what's essentially three generations of a family in the wake of slavery in the South in America. And
right.
That's an amazingly good book as well. It's quite a difficult read in some respects, but it's a really, really good one. But once again, you have coloured protagonists. And again, that's not something you can't just, for all the literary fiction out there, you can't pick those books up a lot of the time.
No. It just gets on my nerves a little bit. It really does, because I just think that there are plenty of things in sort of genre fiction. And I'm going to say YA as well, because, you know, we mentioned Lord of the Rings earlier, and you said that it was written for children. Do we get literary fiction for children? We get literary fiction which children can read. I mean, you could say To Kill a Mockingbird. Would you consider that to be literary fiction?
That's a tricky one, really, because that has changed classifications about six times in the last, 50 years.
Yeah.
I find it literary in the sense of it's factual and clean, and it has that clean, clear prose instead of the, like, really airy-fairy sort of lyrical prose. But technically, it's not really literary, in my opinion. But then other people have classified it as literary, as historical, as children's fiction, as adult fiction. So, you know, it just goes to show that you might not be writing for the audience that you eventually are writing for in 20 years' time.
So, yeah, no, it's a hard thing. And what is literary fiction at the end of the day, if it can change classifications? I would certainly have called To Kill a Mockingbird literary fiction. And we're kind of encouraged to read it when we're young. It's one of the books that we study.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't call it a young adult book.
No,
it's a classic.
Yeah, it's accessible because of its very young protagonist and the pitch-perfect portrayal through a young girl's eyes.
Yeah.
You know, the voice is, like, spot on. It's quite rare to get a... She's an inadequate narrator, Scout. And, it's quite rare for people to absolutely hit that absolute perfect pitch for a child's inadequate voice. In fact, the only other one I've seen that sort of rivals that is... written by a friend of mine, Mandy Berryman, who wrote Home, and that came out earlier this year. And it in the same sort of way, pitch perfect hits that child's voice.
Yeah, and this is the problem with genre, is that we always imagine that it has these set walls, and it really doesn't. Books can move within genres.
Yeah.
They're like ghosts. They can just slip between these imaginary walls.
I think people forget that genre was a... It was literally an invention so that bookshop owners, bookkeepers. I quite like that as a job title, actually.
Yeah. Bookkeeper. I am the bookkeeper.
But not in the boring maths and accounts way. So bookshop owners and libraries knew where to put books in order for the readers who loved those books to be able to find them easily. That's all genre is, ultimately. And it's handy in that respect. When people start getting really wedded to it, it's adding, yet again, a limiting factor to something that already has so many gatekeepers and limits that it's almost not worth it.
Yeah. And it does annoy me. It does.
It's, I suppose it's the snobbery around it, and Howard Jacobson could well have been just making a bit of a joke, as in sort of like, yeah, my books aren't selling, but people always want those mysteries. I mean, who the fuck cares who killed so-and-so? And maybe, in delivery, it was funny. But, as I've said, when you've heard it so many times before that you are inferior because of what you like to write or what you like to read.
Yeah. And that always annoys me, because I just think no one should ever be punished for what they enjoy reading. Unless it's, you know, Mein Kampf and, you know, they're a Nazi. In which case... you should probably be punished a little bit on account of the fact you're a bad person. But you know what I mean? Is that you should never punish people for reading stuff.
No.
And you should never punish people for engaging with a different genre, because each different genre actually has a very different thing to contribute. Science fiction is actually really about questioning the human condition. And science fiction has actually contributed to the technologies that we have nowadays, the way that people interpret information, like the way that we've even been able to be creative. Science fiction has added to that.
Yeah.
And yet people see it as this very kind of silly thing. And it's not. If you think about it, you know, Frankenstein was a piece of science fiction. What was it about? It was about that fear of technology. It was about the human condition and all these new things that were happening and kind of where that might lead to us. Sorry, where that might lead us. And these are not incorrect things to engage. Similarly, I feel like fantasy in a lot of ways deals with some of the present situations and present prejudices under a certain guise. In the same way that magic realism does that, it deals with problems that we are facing now, but wraps it up in a different way so that it can be sold.
Yeah.
But that it can engage the mind. So we often deal with prejudice. We deal with the commercial world. I mean, there's a reason that dystopian fiction suddenly had a boom recently. You know what I mean? And again, this is not lazy. And it's not lazy to be engaged with these things. And it's not lazy to actually be reading these things. They're actually quite harrowing. They're quite difficult. But they're entertaining. And there's nothing wrong with having something which is entertaining but is also, actually, asking you questions, whether you realise it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I've said, the cut-off point for me with literary fiction is when it's style over substance. And if there's no substance, then I'm not interested in reading it. I don't care how beautiful the writing is. And I'm somebody who literally tastes words, so... you know, if I'm not interested in reading it, then that's not to say it's not worth reading. It's just a case of that's clearly, I've got quite a high tolerance for stuff. But
yeah,
when I say story is king, it's certainly king for me. It's got to have, it doesn't have to be a story I even like, but it has to be a satisfying story. But that isn't to say that all literary fiction has to have a story, and a lot of it doesn't.
Mm.
Which is fine. If that's what you like to read, that again is also fine, but thou and I shall never discuss books together.
But it's the idea, it's the like, oh, it's because readers are lazy nowadays, they can't be bothered to put in the effort. And I'm like, I'm sorry, if you as a writer can't be bothered to put the effort into making this an enjoyable read,
yeah, why
then
should
why
I?
The hell should I pay for this if it's not going to engage me on several levels, when another book can engage me on those several levels? Very simple.
I mean... every year we have a couple of people who will come into the library and they will order every single book in that has ever, that has on that particular year turned up on a certain prize list.
Yeah.
So the Man Booker. I want to read all 50 books off the Man Booker prize list. I'm like, okay, fine. I might end up reading some of the Man Booker prize nominees by accident. I don't go seeking them out. And normally I've got a pretty good idea who the top 10 are and who the winner is, just because of where I work.
Yeah.
But I always find that a really weird thing to do, as in your metric for whether something is good and worthwhile to read is whether or not it made it onto a prize list. Knowing a little bit more about how those prize lists work, or have at least worked up to date, they do tend to cut off a lot of people who possibly should have more of a shot at the prize. They're not fixed, I'm not saying that at all, but there is still a bit of an old boys club around a lot of it.
Yeah.
So, to limit yourself to the 50 books that happen to turn up on the Man Booker prize list, it seems a bit short-sighted to me. And I always find that weird, because what you're really saying there, to me, is not that I can't choose my own books. It's what you seem to be saying is, I only want to be seen reading books that clearly have literary merit, whether I enjoy them or not. And yeah. The thing is, I know a couple of these people, they'll come in, and 90% of the books on the list, they won't have enjoyed. I'm like, why don't you try this? Why don't you try this new crime novel? Oh, no, I can't do that. It's like, well, I've actually read that and I know it's pretty good.
Yeah. That is what irritates me. And again, it perpetrates that whole very narrow vision of a very limited group of people. Because as you say, it's a bit of an old boys club, and it narrows your mind as far as I'm concerned. If you are unwilling to actually read things from a different perspective, and that means reading South American authors, that means reading, you know, own voices. And again, I cannot begin to stress enough the fact that these are voices which will not often fall into the literary genre, simply for the merit of who they are, and possibly because of what they are writing. They will be disqualified from a genre. So if you only work within that genre, only read within that genre, you're actually cutting out a huge spectrum of the entire world, which might very well have been, their writing might very well have been considered just as beautiful, just as provoking as anything else. But just because they are a person of colour and are talking about slavery, they said, no, this is this genre instead, or magic realism had to be created because, you know, God forbid people actually write about what was happening in South America at the time, and is still currently happening, straight out. You know, you really do need to be careful. And again, this is not me shitting on literary fiction either.
No, definitely. I mean, I've liked quite a bit of literary fiction. I consider Margaret Atwood literary, although she calls herself more slipstream. So somewhere between literary and science fiction, and she's got a point. But I would have said she was a literary writer and one of the foremost literary writers that I've ever read.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose that's the problem, isn't it? There's no real defined definition of what literary fiction really is, unless a select group of people who seem to have the keys to the kingdom at the moment say it is. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you're narrowing your worldview if all you want to do is read literary fiction. Obviously, if that's what you prefer, if you prefer that sort of style and prose and everything, you know, good on you. There's nothing wrong with that at all. Although I'm a bit surprised you're listening to our podcast, to be honest. Because we almost exclusively talk about genre fiction.
You don't belong here. Get out.
How did you come by these ways? Is the door not guarded?
Are you lost?
You must answer me these riddles three.
Three. Okay, if we haven't lost them now, Jules, then...
They're obviously in for long haul.
Yeah. We've converted
them. I mean, ultimately, there's no more merit in literary fiction than there is in genre fiction. And no. I get it. That another very brief history lesson. This time we're going to go back to the 40s, 50s and 60s.
Whoosh, 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 whoosh.
See, that time machine just sounds really sick. As in, not sick maybe, as in good, as in sick as in it's dying kind of thing. We might
it's
get stuck
very
in
hot,
60s, guys.
Jules, okay? It's very hot. Give the engines a break.
yeah. And there was a huge boom on the pulp novel. And so you can have the slightly finer versions, such as H. Rider Haggard and Edgar Rice Burroughs, which I still enjoy reading, although they're horribly racist if you read them now. As in, painfully, painfully racist. Go into them knowing that if you decide to read any. And there are so many unknown science fiction writers now who made a decent living writing pulp novels. And what they would do was they'd have the weekend and they'd knock out a novel in 48 hours, send it off, and it would be published because there was such a huge demand for it, which means that there was a lot of shit published at that time. And that's why we had a downtick in whether science fiction and by extension fantasy was considered worthy reading material. And they weren't entirely wrong, but it was still entertainment.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that the publishing has changed now.
Yeah.
It has changed now. And I think people get wary because obviously there's self-publishing now as well. And people say, oh, you can just publish anything you want. And I'm like, yeah,
you can.
Except if you do publish anything you want without doing it, you know, doing quality checks and stuff like that, you'll notice very quickly that people aren't buying it.
Yeah, you will be pilloried.
It is simple as that.
Yeah, it's not quite as simple as, well, I'm going to write a first draft and then send it out. And some people do that. But the trouble is, you then get reported, well, I don't know personally, but I mean, you would get reported on Amazon for quality issues and they can then depublish whatever you've put up until you fix it.
Yeah.
And readers are not stupid. This is the thing I think that gets me most about this article, is the sense that readers don't know what they like to read, and that they're being told by publishers who produce mysteries and things, or self-publishers, or indie publishers, or whatever, that what they want is to read is this. And it's not that. All readers are incredibly discerning. You might not get what they like to read. Quite frankly, I don't understand the Mills and Boone thing. I never will, probably. But Mills and Boone readers are very sophisticated within that spectrum. What they want, they're very, very picky.
Yeah.
I'll come back to Mills and Boone in a minute, actually, because that's a good example. So, yeah, this idea that your reader is stupid is, like, quite frankly, insulting and very short-sighted.
It is. And to be honest, I don't think it's a very good idea to insult the people who you're relying on for patronage.
No.
It's a bit of a Ross Poldark move. Sorry, I've been watching Poldark. So. I'm going to shit where I eat.
So yeah,
which I think people do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, kind of. But okay, that was an incredibly gross image. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So yeah, the idea that there is a lot of shit out there self-published. Well, yes, there is. You know what? It doesn't sell. You might sell one, and then that author is pretty much done. If they
don't at least
have some basics.
There is some shit out there which has been properly published as well.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, but we have no control over that. So.
We don't. The fact of the matter is that actually people are complaining about it and they're saying, oh, there's no quality control. And actually, you know what? Good. Good there's no quality control, because you know who's in charge of the quality control people. And you know who's in charge, and how are those people selected? Not fairly. It is an old boys club. And yeah, we may get some women in there and we may get a few sort of people of colour. But my God, they're not representative of everybody. They can't be. They can't be representative of every voice out there. So actually, having only one group of people who have that quality control, or having a very tightly knit band of people who all went to the same university and who were all part of the same group and who all did the same disgusting trials together that they did, you know, like putting your privates in a pig's mouth. I'm not mentioning anybody. But you know what I mean? It's an old boys club. It's a group thing. And if they're the ones who are deciding what is worthy of reading or not, that's not fair.
I think
dad and I have vastly different ideas of what should be read or not. But anyway, my point is that actually having a lack of quality control, we are the quality control, we the readers. Because there will be something out there which I will find to be beautiful and brilliant, that other people will not enjoy. But that doesn't mean it's not worth reading.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to clarify, you are more talking about the big five, big four, big six, whichever, because they do keep changing publishers with that.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I was more talking along sort of the line of, you know, the old history behind it. I was going back, and then I brought politics into it. I'm very sorry.
No, that's fine.
Mr. Cameron, if you're listening, sorry.
No, there is absolutely, all joking aside, there is absolutely politics in writing and in publishing, but we won't go into that too much. It's beyond the scope of the episode. Going back to what I was saying about Mills and Boone. A while back, I did a knowing your customer type course at work. We were asked to choose a book we wouldn't read. And I said, that's, you know, I literally have read everything. And they said, you can't have read everything. I said, well, I'm not saying I've read everything. I'm saying I would, you know, I've given pretty much everything a go. So I got assigned the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. Which was, well, I won't say it was enlightening, but it was an eye-opener. And I was also assigned a Mills and Boone novel. I can't remember what that Mills and Boone novel was about. I tried. It was kind of like every time I turned the page, it erased the previous page. And looking at it from a objective perspective? Anyway, looking at it with
beautiful.
I'm a wordsmith.
That's the point, Jill.
With a bit of distance, Mills and Boone is very tightly structured, and it hits a certain number of beats, it hits a certain number of tropes. It's unfortunate that all those beats and those tropes are things I intensely dislike. That just means I am outside the target audience. It doesn't mean the books are bad. And there are literary writers who are award-winning. I'm thinking Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who wrote Purple Hibiscus and Half of a Yellow Sun and won the Man Booker Prize and various other things. Growing up in South Africa, she actually lived on Mills and Boone. And then went on to become a prize-winning author. So you absolutely can't say, with the sort of snobbery that I traditionally have reserved for things like Mills and Boone, that they're not worthwhile. Because they clearly do something for someone. You know, it's escapism. It's words going in. It's feeding that part of your brain and keeping it going.
Yeah.
And you never know what might come out of it, clearly. As I said, I'm completely outside the target audience for it. I was completely outside of the target audience for 50 Shades of Grey. If I hadn't been assigned it, I wouldn't have read it. It was bad. It was badly written, in my opinion. And yet it has sold millions of copies. You know, absolute millions. It hit a niche that was empty, which is probably more by luck than judgment, but ultimately it did fulfil a need.
Yeah.
Enough so that some big publishers would throw some strong arm behind it and get it out there. And you know what? If you happen to be listening to this and think, oh, I really loved 50 Shades of Grey, that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, you're basically dead to me, but, you know, it's fine.
Sure.
I don't mean that at all. Some of the things that I, you know, okay, confession time. There is a trilogy that is out of print now called The Year of the Cat. And I can't remember the name of the author. But it was one of the point horror things. I used to love point horror as a teenager. We didn't have proper YA fiction back then. So it was point horror. It was their way of getting young adult fiction out there in a time when there was no young adult fiction. There was mid-grade and there was adult.
Yeah.
And it's a point horror collection about shape-shifting panther people.
Excellent.
And it is basically the Mills and Boone of the horror world. And I managed to track down a second-hand copy of this trilogy. And I've reread it, and I still enjoyed it, even though I can see that it's utter rubbish. So everyone gets their trashy fix from somewhere, including me.
Yeah, they do. Man, I've read some terrible stuff, but you know what? So it's like sweets.
Yeah.
You know, you're allowed to just enjoy things. It's okay.
Yeah, not everything has to be a full meal. Sometimes you just want a handful of popcorn.
Yeah.
Kind of
it's
like...
It's the kind of thing... you read on a beach, you know? Something a bit trashy, something that you don't really mind if it gets a bit wet.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know you do, books are sacred, but...
Yeah, I was just trying to think, have I ever got a book wet?
My God, I am terrible to my poor books. They have bad spines and everything. It's bad. As far as I'm concerned, it's a sign of affection for me. If they're all dog-eared, it means that I've carried them around in my handbag so that I can get little snips of it as I'm out in public.
I love you, therefore I abuse you.
That's how I work with my characters, so I figured it would work for books as well.
Well, it's definitely how you work with your characters. So, yes, snobbery across genres exists, most definitely, and I'm not saying I'm immune to it, because I still can't help a slight knee-jerk, Mills and Boone, and yet at the same time I acknowledge that it's a perfectly worthy subsection of a genre to want to be invested in. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that at all. My gran used to read absolutely loads of them. Could never understand the attraction, but she did.
So, can you remember the first piece of literary fiction that you've read?
I might not have called it literary fiction. And, well, it's difficult, isn't it? Do you mean literary fiction as in postmodern or modern type fiction? Or can I include? Either. Because if you I was including sort of 19th century stuff, then I'd be looking at probably Oliver Twist or Les Misérables, which I read when I was 10 or 11.
What kind of monster are you?
Okay.
Who reads Les Misérables when they're 10 or 11? Who reads Les Misérables in general? My God, it's a tomb. It's designed to crush people. It's not actually supposed to be read, Jules.
I love that book so much. I'm going to reread it again soon because it's been a few years.
No!
But no, it was so frustrating. Our primary school didn't have a school library, and I was in the final class of that school before going off to the convent school, so I would have been 10 actually, and our entire school library for our class was two bookshelves at the back of the room, and it was made up entirely of donated books, so we had all these tattered works of Shakespeare and a couple of Bibles. I was desperate for something to read. Okay, they only had volume one of Les Misérables as well. That was so frustrating. I had to wait like 4 years to find out how that book ended.
They all die, that's the end. Spoiler alert.
No, actual literary fiction where I realised it was literary would probably have been The Handmaid's Tale at a slightly better age of 16.
Oh, Christ.
Although I'm sure some of the stuff we read at the convent would have been considered literary, but I don't know. It wasn't a discussion we really had. I'm sure this literary genre versus genre thing is quite a recent development.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, how would you class... Because I prefer to think of things as the classics, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Rather than literary. So you have the classic. I mean, I heard someone class Shakespeare as literary fiction, and I just think, but it's just penis jokes. Many penis jokes.
But it's ancient penis jokes.
Ancient. Somehow, if a penis joke is very old, and penis jokes and puns.
that's what makes the entire argument utterly redundant. Because if you have something that manages to hold on again, you know, if it passes the test of time, then it becomes literature by default. And some of the things that we consider literature now, like Robinson Crusoe, which is such a pile of shit. In my opinion, it really is. But it's considered literature. And I can't really say that it isn't literature, only that I don't personally consider it to be literature.
It's just words assembled in a vaguely recognisable form on the page.
Awful, awful. Oh, Pamela. Pamela's a dreadful book. But nobody else had written anything like it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we're getting onto the argument with the English canon there, and that's not one I'm going to win.
I think one of the important things is when we look at literary fiction, is also to recognise that literary fiction informed modern fiction.
Yes.
And it did. It sort of raised certain ideas it prompted in a way. So while I have my grievances with literary fiction, more along the lines of the reputation of literary fiction and the snobbery that sometimes comes with it, I do have to recognise, however, that it has its place, and it was an informant to the fiction that we have now. So at the end of the day, we've got to be thankful for it. And, you know, I'll still enjoy some literary fiction. I will, if it's the right kind of book for me. But I definitely don't go seeking it out.
Yeah. So if you had one particular area of fiction that you felt like an instinctive, knee-jerk bit of snobbery towards, what would that be?
Well, it probably is a literary fiction, if I'm honest. But I do think that that comes from my dyslexia, in that literary fiction was actually harder for me to understand.
Yeah, it's not the friend, is it, really?
No, it was quite experimental. As far as I was concerned, it was quite experimental. With and storytelling for me and characters were always the thing which could pull me into a story. That's what I needed. I kind of needed that spark of magic, which would basically pull me through. My God, I would never have gotten into reading if it weren't for Harry Potter and the sheer desire that I had to find out what happened next with these characters.
Yeah.
Harry Potter is not literary fiction. I would never... If people had sat down and said, here's some Dickens.
I'd be like, no.
Off you go.
I would have...
That's just a giant nope from me. I would never, and they, you know, they had, and I felt that there was this element of snobbery because people were reading these things, they were appreciating them, and I already had a chip on my shoulder with the feeling of very much being not good enough in that respect, and sort of to always have that kind of thing lauded over me. I spent a little while actually trying to adhere to it and trying to read as much literary fiction as I could and sort of being a bit of a prat, to be honest, and being sort of like, oh yes, aren't I better than everybody else? And then I kind of snapped out of that bullshit and went sort of, why? Why am I better than everybody else? I didn't enjoy any of this. I honestly didn't enjoy any of this. And I also snapped out of saying, you know, I make fun of Twilight and stuff like that. But, you know, I read it and I liked it. I liked it at the time.
Yeah.
For what it was. I never at any point turned around and said, well, this is the goal. In 1,000 years' time, people are going to be like, oh, Twilight. You know, it's not going to... Maybe they will, but it's not going to be considered a classic. But it is going to be considered an influential piece of work for the period that it was written in, because it is an influential piece of work.
Yeah.
For genre. So, yeah, though, I get a little bit funny about literary fiction because I fell into that when I was younger, and I was resentful to it as well, and it still makes me feel uncomfortable because to this day I still struggle to read it, despite the fact that I read so much. And I also found that it didn't represent me, my voice, or the kind of person that I was. And I also tended to find that most of the female characters were not that interesting. But again, probably limited to the literary fiction that I was reading, which was old literary fiction rather than some of the more modern classics that we're seeing now. So yeah, I have read some good literary fiction, but for the most part, actually, I do steer away from it. I tend to enjoy lurking in the... Sorry, that sounds a bit gross. I lurk in the children's section. No, I like reading
the whole thing.
I know. It sounds a bit weird. I like looking at children's book. I like the YA, and I like sort of fantasy. And I'm not ashamed of that. And I like my crime as well. I'll take that box.
Yeah.
And my romance.
I think part of the problem for me was that it got in the way of me actually getting on and writing something, because I thought you should write in a literary style. I thought that should be what you were aiming for. And
yeah.
I sound like a pretentious ass when I write literary fiction. I might not sound like that now, but when I was learning, that's what I sounded like. Because it didn't fit. That wasn't naturally where I wanted to go. I had zero interest in what I was writing, really, in that respect. So why anyone would have had any interest in reading it, I can't imagine. When I finally bust that and thought, no, I'm just going to write a ghost story, I was fine. So I think that's the problem, that this idea that that should be what you should be emulating, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it gets in the way of creativity. I mean, the important thing is just to remember to be true to yourself. And it's also good to experiment. Maybe you'll find something you enjoy. And maybe in a few years' time, Jules, you'll suddenly go, actually, there's a story I want to tell, and it will be literary fiction, you know?
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, just don't shit on other genres and don't shit on what people like to read. It's so simple.
Yeah, that's not a difficult one, really, is it? It's just kind of like, okay, well, you do you.
Yeah, it's allowed. And I think that we have run out of time.
We have. It's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and Madeline's taking it this week.
I am. So this is actually a book that I read a little, quite a while ago, that I really enjoyed, and it's called The Icarus Girl, and it's by Helen Oyeyemi, and I hope I've said her surname right. And it's just brilliant, and I'm trying to sort of properly describe kind of what it is. It's psychological fiction. But it kind of really, really touches down on that. There's an element of magic realism into it as well. And, you know, I would actually put it into that. I would say it's straying into literary fiction as well. And it follows a young girl called Jessamy, who is half... Her mother is from Africa. The continent. I'm trying to remember exactly which part of Africa it is. So I realise that that's not very helpful. She's from all of Africa. Yeah, she's Nigerian, that's it. So her mother's Nigerian, her father is English. And she's kind of stuck between these two worlds. And she ends up kind of with this doppelganger, an imaginary friend who might actually be not so imaginary and might not actually be very friendly. And it was one of the stories that got really under my skin. I found the writing to be beautiful. I found the imagery to be very vivid, but also it was very plain in a lot of ways. So I do highly, highly recommend it in that the way that the story was told, it was told through Jessamy's eyes, and she's very young, and very, very interesting, really, really well put together. And it got under my skin in a lot of ways. I just couldn't put it down. So that really is my recommendation for the week, The Icarus Girl by Helen Oyeyemi. So there you go.
Cool.
And Jules hasn't read it.
I haven't read that one. No.
I suggested it, and Jules was like, oh, I haven't heard of it. And I was like, oh, a book that Jules doesn't know. I found the Holy Grail. Because it's not just a book that Jules doesn't know. It's a book that Jules doesn't know that I've actually read. And I was just there like, oh, it was amazing.
There was a beam of light and everything.
Yeah.
Contrary to popular belief, I haven't read everything in the universe. I really haven't. Lies.
So there we go. And on that note, guys, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.